content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 22nd, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The fight over Obama's trade deal. What happened? Legislation designed to ease the passage of a key trade deal with Asia appeared headed for approval in the Senate this week, despite a brief but embarrassing rebellion by Senate Democrats against President Obama. Obama had made it a priority to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, a broad accord facilitating greater economic cooperation with Japan, South Korea, and nine other nations. But an attempt to introduce fast-track legislation, which would limit congressional oversight of the trade deals to a simple up-or-down vote, was initially blocked by Senate Democrats who fear it will amplify the destructive impact of globalization on U.S. manufacturing jobs. After the bill was delayed, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader Harry Reid worked out a compromise that would enable many Democrats to drop their opposition. That deal would allow a separate vote on legislation Democrats have been demanding that would penalize China for allegedly manipulating its currency to make its exports cheaper. Senator Bill Nelson, a Florida Democrat, said of the fast-track legislation, "It's going to pass." The fast-track bill would then go to the House, where it would also meet Democratic resistance. Opposition to the TPP, which would be the biggest trade agreement since the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement, has been spearheaded by Senator Elizabeth Warren. Supporters of the TPP argue that it would remove barriers to vital Asian markets for American businesses, increase exports, and help contain China's regional clout. But Warren has said it will kill American jobs, lower workers' wages, and possibly enable U.S. banks to adopt foreign banking practices, thus evading Dodd-Frank financial regulation laws. Obama accused his fellow Democrat of political posturing, dismissing her argument as absolutely wrong. What the editorial said: this is what Obama gets when he treats members of Congress as peasants who must bow before his superior wisdom, said the Wall Street Journal. The TPP is the best opportunity in decades to liberalize trade. Yet rather than trying to cultivate coalitions from the center out, Obama alienated protectionists on both the right and left with derision and condescension. If Democrats torpedo this deal in either the Senate or House, China will simply create its own Asia trade agreement, isolating the U.S. and further advancing Beijing's regional and global strategic dominance. The deal as it stands appears to contain some worrying provisions, said the New York Times. It would allow countries to adopt strict pharmaceutical patent regulations that could make many medicines unaffordable to poor people, and does nothing to stop countries from artificially depressing their currencies to boost exports, something that hurts U.S. businesses and workers. But Obama can address these concerns with amendments and more transparency. A compromise would be good for the American economy. What the columnist said: the TPP stinks, said David Dayan in Salon.com. While Obama repeatedly boasts that the accord involves 40% of the world's GDP, the U.S. already has trade deals with six of the 11 other countries. So the TPP would have virtually no significance in opening new markets. All it would do is send more jobs abroad. Ask the former employees of now shuttered American factories how past trade deals have worked out for them. Democrats can't stop the rising tide of globalization, said Zachary Carabel in Politico.com. The TPP will at best remove friction from international trade by eliminating tariffs. But with or without those tariffs, global trade will continue to expand rapidly, and jobs will continue to move to low-wage Asian countries. If the cost of doing business with the U.S. is too high, other countries will find alternatives elsewhere, and we'll lose out on expanded markets and cheaper imports. Retreating into a fairy tale that we can halt this tide will only hasten the U.S.'s economic decline. Even though Warren's victory was temporary, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, the rebellion she led may have been a turning point for Democrats. Even former TPP supporter Hillary Clinton was cowed into silence, emboldening other Democrats to rebel. With public anger over growing inequality now at critical mass, Warren and her fellow populists have proved they are firmly in control of the Democratic Party. And a second main story, Amtrak disaster in Philly. Transportation officials said this week that a devastating Amtrak crash in Philadelphia that killed at least seven people and injured another 150 was likely caused by excessive speed. Northeast Regional Train 188 was traveling from Washington, D.C. to New York City when it derailed near a sharp bend in Philadelphia's Port Richmond neighborhood. Data retrieved from the train's black box recorders indicate the train entered the curve at 106 miles per hour, twice the speed limit for that stretch of track. All seven cars derailed, hurling passengers into luggage racks and trapping them under the carriage's mangled metal frames. It was just chaos and craziness, said passenger Jeremy Lottis. Hours after the disaster, Republicans on a House committee blocked a previously scheduled bid by Democrats to boost Amtrak's funding. A proposed GOP transportation bill would instead cut Amtrak's budget by $251 million. Amtrak is in a sorry state, said Simon Van Zuylen Wood in NationalJournal.com. The government-owned company runs a fleet with an average age of nearly 30 years. And receives a federal subsidy of just $1.4 billion a year, compared with $8 billion the U.K. gives its rail system and the $128 billion China spends. America's only high-speed train runs at an average of 68 miles per hour, 100 miles per hour than the genuinely high-speed trains in Europe and Asia. Then there are the crashes, which are far too common, said Steve Molman in QZ.com. The Philadelphia derailment was the ninth this year alone. Blame Republicans, said Aviva Shin in thinkprogress.org. Even as Amtrak ridership has increased by 50% in the past 15 years, conservative lawmakers have proposed massive cuts to Amtrak's budget virtually every chance they get. If Congress continues to ignore America's crumbling rail infrastructure, expect only more dysfunction and more breakdowns in the system. Amtrak has a lot of problems, said Sean Davis in TheFederalist.com. A lack of taxpayer generosity is not one of them. Federal taxpayers dump over $1 billion each year into the company, money that should be spent on infrastructure, but is more often used to cover Amtrak's salary costs and pension losses. If you want to fix Amtrak, the solution's simple. Give it to a private company that actually knows what it's doing. Our controversy of the week. Surveillance. Is the NSA's metadata program too intrusive? America lost its mind in the panicky aftermath of 9/11, said Steve Chapman in Reason.com. But there are finally signs that sanity is making a comeback. Last week, a federal appeals court ruled that the National Security Agency's once secret program to collect data on the phone calls of all Americans is illegal. Defenders of the program, which was exposed by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, had claimed it was authorized by the 2001 Patriot Act, which lets intelligence services seize any tangible thing with relevance to a counterterrorism investigation. The NSA twisted the language to include not only the phone records of suspected terrorists, but also records of every phone call made by everyone in the country. The court stopped short of shutting down the metadata program, said Andrea Peterson in WashingtonPost.com, but only because the relevant clause in the Patriot Act is due to expire on June 1st anyway. The judges said they'd defer to Congress, which is now hotly debating the future of government spying. This would be a terrible time to tie the government's hand, said Fred Flights in NationalReview.com. After two ISIS-inspired American jihadists tried last week to shoot up a Draw Muhammad competition in Texas, FBI Director James Comey warned that ISIS has contacted hundreds, maybe thousands, of potential jihadists in the U.S. through social media. So Congress needs to think long and hard before it scraps or weakens the NSA's metadata collection program. Remember, the NSA doesn't listen in to our phone calls. It merely collects data on when calls are placed and to whom for the sole purpose of uncovering terrorist networks. That task is only possible if the NSA has a complete historical archive of phone records, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. You can't connect the dots without, well, dots. If this program is so vital, said Noah Feldman in BloombergView.com, Congress should authorize it explicitly. Until Snowden blew his whistle, not even members of Congress knew about the program. However well-intentioned, secret laws are anathema to the democracy. A proposed bill called the USA Freedom Act would allow the NSA to search the nation's phone metadata, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. But first, it would need a warrant from a judge. Most importantly, the data would be stored by the phone companies, not the government. That sensible precaution would make it much harder for some modern-day Richard Nixon or J. Edgar Hoover to exploit the system and spy on political enemies. Please spare me the hand-wringing of civil libertarians, said L. Gordon Krovitz in the Wall Street Journal. Is it really so intrusive to have phone records stored in NSA computers when private companies such as Google and Facebook are collecting, mining, and selling staggering amounts of information about every one of us on a daily basis? In the era of big data, the agencies that protect us from terrorists should have access to the same tools as the companies that sell us products. You vastly underestimate the NSA, said James Bamford in Reuters.com. Snowden revealed the agency is also mapping every internet connection, cell phones, laptops, tablets, of everyone on the planet, and has spied on porn sites so as to discredit radicalizers who use them. Do you really want to trust this agency with a blank check? Far too many of us have come to accept highly intrusive surveillance as the new normal. Well, it was a good week for the Windy City. After Barack Obama announced that his future presidential library will be located on Chicago's South Side, all the strands of my life came together, and I really became a man when I moved to Chicago, Obama said. It was a good week for civility, after a study found that public approval of the U.S. Congress has risen and fallen over 18 years in correlation to the members' political rhetoric, with the use of words like tolerate, trust, and cooperate leading directly to increases in popularity. And it was a good week for the male ego, after a British survey found that the average man looks at himself in the mirror 23 times a day, compared with 16 times for women. Men like to admire their appearance, researchers found, while women simply make sure they look okay. It was a bad week for greener grass, after aerial photographs revealed that estates owned by Barbara Streisand, Jennifer Lopez, Kim Kardashian, and Kanye West still boasted green lawns and lush gardens despite water restrictions imposed during the worst drought in California history. It was a bad week for pit stops, after passengers on a three-hour Ryanair flight from Murcia, Spain to London were informed upon takeoff that the plane had no toilet paper on board. Everyone had horrified looks on their faces, one passenger reported. And it was a bad week for self-indulgence, after a government watchdog group reported that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie spent nearly all of his $360,000 state expense allowance on food and alcohol over the past 5 years, including over $82,000 on concessions at MetLife Stadium. On the briefing page this week, ending the Ebola epidemic. Last year, a devastating Ebola outbreak in West Africa killed thousands. Today, the disease is under control. Is the crisis over? Not yet, but the signs are good in all three afflicted countries. Liberia was officially declared free of Ebola last week, after 42 days with no new cases, while Guinea and Sierra Leone together recorded just 18 new infections the week before last, the lowest total this year. By comparison, at the peak of the outbreak last fall, the deadly disease was infecting about 400 people a week in Liberia alone. So although the death toll keeps climbing, it has now passed 11,000, with 26,628 total cases. The worst seems to be over. The Pentagon has pulled out all but 100 of the 2,800 troops sent to assist the authorities in the region, and health officials are hoping to identify and isolate all remaining cases in the region before the rainy season begins in June. As one U.S. military official put it, "We got a handle on Ebola a lot quicker than anyone expected." Was the danger exaggerated? Some of the warnings by public officials seem, in retrospect at least, overstated. In September, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that Ebola could infect as many as 1.4 million people. Jeffrey Hawkins, the U.S. Consul General in Nigeria, warned of the possibility of an apocalyptic urban outbreak. When President Obama asked Congress for $6 billion in funding to help combat the disease, he called the epidemic a national security priority. But although the doomsaying may seem excessive now, it did focus the world's attention on a disaster that was threatening to spiral out of control. It was the worst Ebola outbreak in history, killing five times more people than all previous Ebola epidemics combined. How was it contained? By educating West Africans on how Ebola is transmitted and by aggressive efforts to isolate and treat the infected. When the outbreak began 16 months ago, healthcare workers in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone were initially fighting blind. Doctors and nurses had to learn from scratch how to treat Ebola. The odds of survival dramatically increased with early effective symptom management and how to contain it. Helped by more than 10,000 volunteers from around the world, health workers gradually taught people to avoid unnecessary physical contact, to go to a clinic the moment they displayed symptoms, and to forego the traditional ritual of washing corpses, a practice that accelerated the spread of the disease. The best way to fight Ebola, said Joseph Boy Cooper, a volunteer worker in Liberia, is to prevent it. Did the U.S. military help? Forbidden by the Pentagon from working directly with patients, the troops sent to Liberia focused on building treatment centers. But by the time they finished the first U.S.-supported clinic in November, infection rates were already in significant decline. In total, the 11 clinics they built treated just 28 Ebola patients. Nine centers haven't had a single case. Jeremy Cornedyke, who headed the Ebola response for the U.S. Agency for International Development, insists the abundance of caution was warranted. You don't know where the fire is going to break out, he says, but you're going to need a fire station there when it does. U.S. troops also helped in other ways, training hundreds of healthcare workers and airlifting supplies and medical teams around the region. What's next for the countries affected? If Sierra Leone and Guinea join Liberia in becoming Ebola-free, the first priority will be rebuilding their shattered healthcare systems. The epidemic not only killed an astonishing 10% of the country's healthcare workers, but also sucked up pretty much every available medical resource. As a result, around 250,000 children across the region missed out on basic vaccinations, raising the specter of an outbreak of measles or another disease. The threat of Ebola, meanwhile, will always remain. The virus lurks in infected bats and other animals, which can spread it to humans. But if there's another outbreak, West Africa will undoubtedly be much, much better prepared to respond. How about the rest of the world? The World Health Organization, WHO, which was heavily criticized for its lackluster initial response, has warned that the world is ill-prepared for another large and sustained disease outbreak. If Ebola ever gains a foothold in China or India, where the population density is high and the healthcare infrastructure deeply inadequate, the death toll could be catastrophically high. But the epidemic in West Africa has given health experts invaluable experience for dealing with future outbreaks. And there are already plans for establishing a global fast response team to prevent something similar from happening. The hardest task may be sustaining enough interest in the issue to ensure reforms are made. 6 months ago, the world was worried, said WHO's Dr. Bruce Aylward. There was a lot of self-interest in making sure this thing was stopped. The biggest mistake the world could do right now is blink. Take a look now at a few columns. The first comes from Ezra Klein at Vox.com. The Great Mother's Day Hypocrisy. Once a year, Americans honor mothers with Hallmark cards and flowers. But motherhood is not a job America rewards, said Ezra Klein. Motherhood is rightly known as the toughest job in the world, with moms working more than 100 hours a week, including nights, weekends, and holidays. About 70% of women doing this work now also work outside the home. But unlike nearly every other country in the Western world, the U.S. guarantees women no paid maternity leave whatsoever. Given that 40% of American moms are their household's primary earner, that leaves many mothers having to choose between spending a month with their newborn child or keeping a roof over their child's head. Compare that with Sweden, where parents receive 480 paid days per child, split between moms and dads. To add insult to injury, studies have shown moms face strong workplace discrimination, with bosses and coworkers viewing them as less reliable and less competent. Indeed, moms face a 5% wage penalty for every child they have. Flowers and cards are nice, But if America really valued mothers, we wouldn't treat them like this. From the Netherlands, Frans Welsglas, at Trouw, Europeans were once refugees. These desperate migrants crossing the Mediterranean, struggling to reach safety in Europe, are my family 70 years ago, said Frans Welsglas. World War II sent thousands of Europeans, including Jews like my mother, scrambling across borders to safety. My mother wrote a book about her journey from German-occupied Netherlands through Belgium and France to the safety of neutral Switzerland. She was safe, and I grew up to become head of the Dutch Parliament. Yet what if the Swiss had refused her shelter? It is distressing how many similarities there are between my mother's story and those of the Syrians and Africans fleeing violence, oppression, and discrimination. Now, as we do every May, we celebrate the end of the war, and we celebrate our freedom. Are we to do so by barring the door against those who have no freedom? Some of the most supposedly patriotic Dutch, who speak so proudly of our resistance during the war, are the very same who call asylum seekers criminals. The lesson we should draw from World War II is not just the value of resistance, but also the imperative of compassion. The Netherlands is now a wealthy democracy. We owe it to our own history to be open and welcoming to the less fortunate. And a How They See Us article. The growing U.S.-Saudi rift. The new Saudi king has performed quite the snub of President Obama, said the Daily Star from Lebanon in an editorial. King Salman, the Saudi monarch since January, had said he would attend Obama's summit with Gulf leaders at Camp David this week, only to cancel at the last minute with a transparently thin excuse. Such rude behavior would be shocking even from an enemy, let alone a close ally. But Obama should have seen it coming. The rift between Riyadh and Washington has been widening since Obama took office. Faced with a rising Iran, Saudi Arabia needs a strong and steadfast ally, yet it has found in Washington merely a salesman keen to sell its weapon systems to the region. The Saudis and other Gulf allies just don't trust the U.S. anymore, said Salman al-Dosari in Asharq al-Aswat from the U.K. The Camp David summit was arranged to convince Arab states that Obama's deal with Iran won't undermine their security. But that's going to be a tough sell. The U.S. has lost credibility by constantly changing course on crises in Europe and Iraq. And Obama's word has been suspect ever since he declared that Syria's use of chemical weapons would be a red line and then stood idle as that line was crossed. Obama now wants to lift sanctions on Iran, whose regime is founded on hostility toward its Arabian Peninsula neighbors, where it plants militant cells and stokes sectarian hatred. To reassure the Arab states, Obama is supposedly offering military cooperation and joint defense plans. Forgive us if we need written guarantees to that effect. The U.S. behaves as if only a nuclear Iran would be a threat, said Talaa al-Abari in Arab News from Saudi Arabia. The fact is, Iran is already destabilizing enough without nuclear weapons. It has armed militants in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Yet the U.S. negotiations with Iran address only its nuclear program and not Iran's hostile adventurism. Thank goodness for the leadership of Saudi Arabia, which has stepped up to battle Iran's Houthi proxies in Yemen. King Salman has demonstrated to Obama and the world that it would be dangerous to tamper with Saudi Arabia. The U.S. administration will see that the Saudi sword has come out of its sheath to uproot the Iranian-backed militias and will not return to it before achieving victory. But there's hope yet for the U.S.-Saudi relationship, said Joyce Karam in Al Arabiya from the United Arab Emirates. King Salman has appointed as his new foreign minister the former U.S. Ambassador Adel Al-Jubeer, graduate of Georgetown University and a longtime Washington insider. It's the first time a non-royal has held the post, but the king apparently wanted someone with strong ties to the U.S. and intimate knowledge of America and Saudi politics. Expect Saudi Arabia to pursue a more proactive foreign policy while still maintaining its long-standing alliance with the United States. As a former basketball player, the Last Word article this week had a certain special appeal to me. The title is Learning How to Dunk. At 34, I gave myself a year to dunk a basketball, said Asher Price. Could my aging body learn a new trick? Everybody wants to dunk, at least metaphorically. We think that if we spent just a year away from our everyday distractions, we could rise above our terrestrial lot, learn Spanish, pick up the piano, remaster calculus, paint. In our fantasies, we think we might all be naturals, capable of mastering some talent hidden inside us. A few years ago, The Onion cheekily mocked our unspent dreams in an obituary with the headline, quote, 97-year-old dies unaware of being violin prodigy. The notion of a hidden talent can haunt, too. My mother stopped making art after a junior high school teacher told her she had little talent. She became an art historian instead, her days spent tromping through museums to examine other people's work. It's a familiar story. We leave our singing in the shower. Most adults never bother to pick up a violin, write fiction, or learn other languages. Why acquire a talent just to explore its limits? I meant to take the dunking metaphor literally. I wanted to slam a basketball through an orange rim. My quest was to make the most of the piece of flesh I'd been given. At the extreme margin of human talent and effort, elite athletes stretch the boundaries that defined our capabilities as a species. Will there come a day, the former Trinidadian sprinter Etho Bolden was once asked, when someone runs the 100-meter dash in less than 9 seconds? The record is now 9.58 seconds set by Usain Bolt. Sprinters believe that someday somebody will run the 100 meters and the clock will read 0.00, Bolden said. It's how you have to think. This idea of human limitation is exactly what we're competing against. I would never run as fast as Bolt or Bolden, but the test I had set for myself was just possibly manageable. Given my height and vague athleticism, I felt that with a lot of effort, I should be able to push a 9.5-inch ball through a 10-foot-high hoop. I faced some challenges. I'm of Austro-Hungarian stock, more closely associated with making good pastries than with jumping ability. At the start of this project, I could only swipe the rim with the tips of my middle and index fingers. I owned healthy love handles. I weighed 203 pounds, so I was going to have to lose weight and put on muscle. But I had some things going for me. Height. I'm 6 feet, 2.5 inches, with orangutan arms. What a former coworker once called a, quote, big old sprinter's butt. Just the kind of powerful posterior I'd need to propel myself hoopward. And, as I neared my 34th birthday, some leftover sportiness. I had never played a varsity sport, but once upon a time I had captained my college frisbee team. I had never weightlifted, either. I despise weightlifting, and so, to my mind at least, I remained a tabula rasa. Pure potential, my wife Rebecca said, with a not-so-small degree of skepticism. In its bones, this is a peculiarly American story, a story about optimism, about self-reliance, about the ability to remake oneself. The dunk is, yes, as American as jazz or apple pie. But it stretches beyond that. It is literally about upward mobility, about the very American idea that everyone is capable of self-improvement, of rising above her lot. For me, the test was physical. For others, the barriers involving everything from class to gender are obviously harder to overcome. Americans have long thought that they could move on up, as they say in the Jeffersons. They believe in self-made men, and that's what I was trying to do, remake myself. I was no kid, making this my last chance to dunk. I gave myself from the end of 1 August to the end of the next to improve. It was a year to discover whether, embedded in my bones, muscles, and DNA, was some grand jumping potential. A year was long enough to train my feet, hips, legs, and butt in the strange art of explosive movement. Any longer, and I figured I'd see diminishing returns. To transform my average Joe body into a svelte jumping machine, I had decided to get some professional help. If I was truly going to test my capabilities and scientifically go about monitoring my performance, I needed some top-shelf trainers on board. I hadn't expected anyone to take me seriously. I wanted to dunk, yes, but the notion of an adult going deliberately about it seemed ridiculous. I wrote emails. I'm interested in the limits of human potential, I explained, as I laid out my project, and then I want to dunk. Many of these emails, unsurprisingly, went unanswered. And then a real-life scientist, a very nice man named Stephen Doty, who had played high school basketball in the 1950s, wrote me back. What a great idea for a story. I, too, only reached the rim, never over it. A couple of weeks later, I found myself hustling to Manhattan's swank Upper East Side neighborhood to meet Stephen, a senior scientist who specialized in the loss of bone density at the Hospital for Special Surgery. He introduced me to a crew of physical trainers who had gamely agreed to help me. The hospital's performance lab looks a little like an overgrown high-end preschool playroom. Large, brightly colored inflatable balls sit on the softly matted ground. Stacks of stepping blocks stand in a corner. Fluorescent lights buzz overhead. This is where the New York Knicks have been put through their paces. So we're going to get you to dunk, right? Polly DeMille, a handsome, sandy-haired reed of a woman, said. Over 3 hours, Polly put me through a battery of exercises to test my capabilities, or deficiencies, as one of her colleagues described them. As it turned out, I was quite deficient. She began by taking baseline measurements of my body and accounting of my flesh and blood vital statistics. First, she performed a skinfold test. I felt a little like a piece of meat on a hook as she measured the body fat around my chest, arms, and legs with a pair of calipers. Her findings? About a fifth of my overall weight was body fat, just worse than the average for men my age. Between my love handles were the modest beginnings of a gut. Polly, who wore a t-shirt that said, "Train like a Nick," told me that basketball players have a body fat percentage of only 10%. To reach that goal and achieve the physique of a prototypical dunker, at my current level of fat-free mass, I would have to cut my overall weight to 171.6 pounds. and it fast became apparent I would have to add some serious muscle. We want you to be strong enough so that it feels like you're jumping off a solid concrete platform, Polly told me. We were joined by Jamie, a small muscular trainer. We're putting together a 52-week regimen for you, he said. He had gotten up at 5:30 that morning to finish it up. I get up that early only if I have to catch an airplane. As I lay down to do some crunches, I suddenly didn't want to disappoint these two people. They already believed in me more than I did. Beneath those fluorescent lights, I told myself I would succeed. I would slam the ball home. The day of the dunk was a Monday in late August. It was my last chance. I had taken it easy the previous few days, tapering off my workouts to rest my leg muscles before their big liftoff. I felt fresh and loose. Charles, my trainer, dribbled the ball by the basket, and I readied myself at half court, running through in my mind's eye the keys to getting up. A small audience gathered. Rebecca for moral support, Charles' assistant, Terrell, a half dozen or so 12-year-olds, all aspiring dunkers, who took a break from their basketball game to watch. It was like high noon, a face-off between me at half court and my nemesis, the rim. On the first jump, I exploded up, swatting the ball toward the back of the iron and then hanging for a second on the rim. Yes, I was ready. Everyone was watching, egging me on. I was getting higher up than I ever really thought possible, but I was not quite putting the dunk down. Again, the ball would leave my hand, only to rattle against the inside back lip of the rim and out. I could not get my arm high enough for the right angle to slam it true. 15 tries, I glanced down at the palm of my left hand to find the joints of my middle and forefinger bloodied from scraping against the rim. 20 minutes later, and my body was out of energy. I had swatted the ball into the hoop, but those efforts didn't quite have the feel and control, the snap, that suggested a true dunk. Charles had thrown the ball up perfectly, tossing it so that it hung in the air like a full moon, and I had, more times than not, gotten my palm onto it. But I hadn't quite gotten all the way on top of the ball. It was just an inch too far, and so I was left slapping the ball toward the basket and hoping it would rattle in. A few did, and a few of those felt right. There had been something of that snappish feeling and the friction of my sliding hand against the warm, curved metal. But as soon as I landed and twisted toward Charles, I would see him shaking his head. So I didn't dunk it, I'd ask, sincerely unsure and genuinely hopeful. He turned to one of the folks watching, a bearded, paunchy guy in glasses, another gym-goer caught up in the hullabaloo. Almost, he said, holding his thick thumb and forefinger in the air, a delicate centimeter apart. This stranger, this random witness, casually pinching my potential between his fingers like a bug. They were turning away now, the boys, one by one standing up and going back to their kid's basket in the corner of the gym, blithely dunking and horsing around. The moment of possibility had imperceptibly turned to a moment of desperation. Charles had a client waiting now, his appointment. His next appointment, my year was up. Just once more, he said for the fifth time. I relaxed. I imagined that thousands of fans were stomping their feet, that cheerleaders waved their pom-poms that Michael Jordan himself was watching, and that Rebecca, filming all this, was NBC television. This was it, the last gasp. I pumped my knees, flew forward, planted hard, drove myself up through the air. I couldn't quite get my hand over the rim. Perhaps if I had tried 1,000 more times, like a kid mastering a video game, I would have. But I hadn't. I had failed. Months after my final dunk attempt, a bag of protein shake mix slumps untouched in the kitchen. My gym membership is long canceled, but I still play pickup basketball. I'm quicker, partly as a matter of confidence. I take guys off the dribble or back them up into the post and try a turnaround jumper. My elevation is still better than it was before I began my crazy experiment. I emerged sinewy, though, and lean, tough. My weight remains pretty good. I eat dessert more freely and am back to my happy pasta-eating ways. But asceticism clings. I used to be a whole milk person. Now I'm a 1% kind of guy. I've been known, even now, to decline the services of a bun with my burger. It's a little sad. One evening every couple of weeks, just as the sun starts to set and the grackles muster along the power lines for their evening gab fest, I make my way to the nearby middle school track and do a lonely set of sprints. I put myself through some push-ups and sit-ups, lowering myself to the ground with enthusiasm of a man getting into a cold bath. It's mostly vanity now. This is what happens once you've found yourself with a six-pack, with higher hops. You find it hard to let yourself go, but I'm trying. This was adapted from Year of the Dunk, A Modest Defiance of Gravity, published in 2015. On the Health and Science page, first article, climate change could cause mass extinction. If climate change continues unabated, 1 in 6 species on Earth could disappear by the end of the century, a new study has found. Some land and sea creatures are already moving to new habitats in response to warmer temperatures, and scientists warn that in coming decades there will be a dramatic increase in the number of extinctions among species that are unable to adapt to heat waves, droughts, floods, and rising sea levels. Perhaps most surprising is that extinction risk does not just increase with temperature rise, but accelerates, curving upward as the Earth warms, said the study's author, Mark Urban, in Smithsonian.com. He and his team analyzed 131 previous studies on how plants, amphibians, fish, mammals, reptiles, and invertebrates were coping with climate change. They concluded that some plant and animal species will die throughout the world, but that South America, Australia, and New Zealand face the largest number of extinctions because many species in these regions rely on unique and isolated habitats and won't be able to move elsewhere. If there is a mass extinction, it will be the sixth in Earth's long history, but the first caused by humans. Losing about 16% of the world's species, researchers warn, would affect global economies, food supplies, and cultures. We had the choice, Urban said. The world can decide where on that curve they want the future Earth to be. The health scare of the week, fructose triggers cravings. Not all sugars are created equal. Glucose and fructose are simple sugars naturally found in fruit and have the same number of calories, but new research suggests there are important differences in how the body responds to these sweeteners. While glucose is absorbed directly into the bloodstream to produce energy, fructose, which is used to sweeten soft drinks and processed foods, is metabolized in the liver. The body reacts to glucose in the blood by producing insulin, which triggers feelings of fullness. Fructose doesn't stimulate insulin secretion, and if there's no insulin, you don't get the information that you're full, the study's senior author, Dr. Kathleen Page, tells the New York Times. Consuming fructose also triggers more activity in areas of the brain involved in reward processing, which intensifies cravings for high-calorie foods such as candy, cookies, and pizza. Researchers do not recommend that people forgo fruit, since it provides fiber and nutrients and has relatively small amounts of fructose compared with soft drinks and processed foods. But researchers say it does make sense to limit overall sugar intake. On the Talking Points page, Jade Helm, The Plot to Take Over Texas. In July, dozens of Black Hawk helicopters will swoop down on southwestern America, depositing Special Forces troops in Texas and six other states, said Amy Davidson in NewYorker.com. For the U.S. military, the event marks the beginning of Jade Helm 15, a routine training exercise. But for a growing number of paranoid conservatives in the Lone Star State, it signifies something much more terrifying: a U.S. military takeover of Texas and beyond. Conspiracy theorists believe President Obama is secretly plotting to seize Texas and other Republican-dominated states. They're moving logistics in place for martial law, Texan Bob Wells told a newspaper reporter. It's the same thing that happened in Nazi Germany. Unfortunately, this crackpot theorizing isn't confined to the furthest corner of the conspiratorial fever swamps, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon.com. Texas Governor Greg Abbott upped the hysteria by ordering the State Guard to monitor the U.S. troops, citing his concern for Texas' constitutional rights. It's official. Anti-Washington derangement has now made it fully into the mainstream. Okay, Obama isn't going to invade Texas, said David French in NationalReview.com, but you can't blame conservatives for feeling a little paranoid. Not when they've been bullied, slandered, and investigated under this administration. Obama's Justice Department has repeatedly called conservative activist groups potential domestic terrorists, and his administration turned one of its most powerful bureaucracies, the IRS, into a weapon, targeting Tea Party groups with systematic audits. He's also flouted the Constitution repeatedly by issuing executive orders. In this atmosphere of earned distrust, it's no wonder that conservative citizens feel targeted and maligned. The levels of paranoia in Texas go far beyond rational boundaries, said Leslie Savon in TheNation.com. This week, Walmart felt obliged to deny a widespread rumor that all its Texas stores were closing so federal officials could use them as internment camps. Senator Ted Cruz and Representative Louie Gohmert joined Governor Abbott in validating the conspiracy theories about Jade Helm, with Gohmert saying, "Patriotic Americans have reason to be concerned." Sadly, it's no longer shocking to hear Republicans talk this way, said Leonard Pitts in the Miami Herald. Today, when a Republican governor calls out guardsmen to ensure that a president doesn't stage a military coup, we shrug because it's just another Tuesday in the lunatic asylum of American politics. And a second Talking Point article: Immigration. Clinton throws down the gauntlet. Hillary Clinton just created a nightmare for the GOP, said Paul Reyes in USA Today. In a canny strategic move, the presumptive Democratic nominee last week announced her support for a full and equal path to citizenship for the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. She also promised to expand President Obama's controversial executive order blocking the deportation of Dreamers, illegal immigrants brought here as kids, to include their parents. With Hispanic votes likely to play a pivotal role in the 2016 election, Clinton is daring Republicans into a fight she knows she can win. Perhaps that's why her announcement left many Republican rivals speechless, said David Nakamura and Robert Costa in the Washington Post. Frontrunners Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, and Scott Walker have all had to shift to the right on immigration to curry favor with the base. But they're desperate to avoid alienating Latinos, who gave several swing states to the Democrats in 2012. Like President Obama, Clinton is more interested in goading Republicans on immigration than in actually fixing our broken system, said Linda Chavez in the New York Post. An amnesty would just exacerbate the problem. When President Reagan granted legal status to 4 million people in 1986, it prompted an influx of 11 million additional illegal immigrants. Besides, Clinton showed no interest in immigration when she was in the Senate or when she ran for president in 2008. Her Republican rivals should focus on Clinton's total lack of credibility, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. By highlighting her cynical exploitation of the issue, Republicans can start building the case that she is no more trustworthy on policy than on email servers or her family foundation. They should also argue that Clinton's promise to expand Obama's executive overreach is a recipe for a third term of confrontation and dysfunction. My fellow Republicans need to take their heads out of the sand, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com. In the wake of Mitt Romney's crushing defeat in 2012, when he picked up just 27% of the Hispanic vote, the GOP leadership acknowledged the need for an immigration reform policy that shows respect for minority groups. Yet 3 years later, they're no closer to finding one. Unless they want to lose in 2016, it's crucial they should produce a sensible response to Clinton's shot across the bow. And we'll finish up the hour today with a quote from Orson Welles, quoted in GQ magazine. He says, "I prefer people who rock the boat to people who jump out." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.